Hello, and welcome to A Health Podicy. I'm your host, Alan Weil. When the COVID-19 pandemic began, there were no vaccines against the novel coronavirus. Instead, we had what are sometimes referred to as non-pharmaceutical interventions, things like closing restaurants, bars, and other places where people congregate or requiring people to wear masks. Even after vaccines were developed, various localities continued to rely upon these sorts of interventions with the goal of reducing the spread of COVID. Now, given that vaccines take time to develop and not everyone becomes vaccinated even after they are available, understanding the effects of non-pharmaceutical interventions is an essential part of planning for the possible next respiratory disease. Did non-pharmaceutical interventions slow the spread of COVID-19? That is the topic of today's episode of A Health Podicy. I'm here with Courtney Baird, a doctoral candidate at Brown University School of Public Health. Ms. Baird and co-authors published a paper in the March 2024 issue of Health Affairs assessing whether or not non-pharmaceutical interventions implemented to slow COVID-19 transmission had their intended effect. They find that indeed they did. We'll discuss the finding in more detail and consider its implications in today's episode. Ms. Baird, welcome to the program.
Hi, Alan. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
This is, of course, a great topic, and we've published a tremendous amount about COVID-19. Most of the discussion today is about vaccines and getting people to get their boosters and the like. It's easy to forget that there was a time when we didn't have them at all, and all we could deploy were these non-pharmaceutical interventions. We may call them NPIs just for short so that the listener knows what we're talking about. So I gave a very brief introduction a moment ago, but why don't you give us a little bit better sense? What are non-pharmaceutical interventions and how were they used during the pandemic?
So non-pharmaceutical interventions, or as you mentioned, they're often referred to as NPIs, are actions apart from getting vaccinated or taking medication that individuals and communities can take to help slow the spread of viruses like COVID-19 or the flu. So at the onset of a new viral pandemic, the main purpose of NPIs is to serve as a stopgap measure to bridge the time between detection of the new virus and the arrival of pharmaceutical treatments for that virus. So in the case of COVID-19, because the SARS-CoV-2 virus was a novel virus that hadn't entered the human population before what we think is about December 2019, we didn't have any natural immunity to that virus, which we all know led to an outbreak and then eventually led to a global pandemic. So because the virus was new, there were no vaccinations, no medications available. And on top of that, we didn't even know which medications were safe or effective for treating patients with COVID-19. I think it's easy for us to often forget that because now, you know, we've got a couple drugs that can reduce viral load and, you know, make the process a lot easier and reduce mortality. But, you know, in the beginning of the pandemic, a lot of these drugs weren't approved yet and we didn't know if they were safe or effective. So without vaccinations or medications, NPIs are really the best way to slow the spread of viruses until we can get to that point where we have vaccines or medicines. So there's many different types of NPIs, which can be grouped into three categories. So the first one is personal NPIs, which include personal protective actions that can help individuals avoid virus exposure. So that includes things like hand washing, wearing face masks, and quarantining. And then environmental NPIs include strategies like improving ventilation, using air filters, disinfecting surfaces, or using, you know, clear plastic sneeze guards. And then finally, the third category is community NPIs, which are strategies and policies implemented at the community level to mitigate an outbreak. So for example, in the beginning of the pandemic, a lot of workplace procedures were often modified to prevent the spread of COVID. So that included strategies like allowing remote work, checking employee temperatures, and limiting the number of people who could work in offices. But community NPIs can also include policies or mandates that are implemented at the county, state, or federal level. And in the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic in the US, as many people remember, these policies mainly included stay-at-home orders or lockdowns, face mask mandates, bans on large gatherings. So that would be banning things like, you know, attending football games and concerts, things of that nature, bar and restaurant closures and restrictions, closures of other non-essential businesses, like, you know, maybe retail stores, mandatory quarantines, travel restrictions, and then also school closures. So our research study focuses on four different NPI mandates that were implemented by counties during the first 2 years of the pandemic. And that includes large gathering bans, stay-at-home orders, bar and restaurant closures, and face mask mandates. And the main reason we focused on these policies and not the others is really just because these were the only MPIs where we could access county-level data from the CDC.
So I appreciate the categorization of NPIs. It's not just one thing. And also the reminder, it wasn't that long ago, that we really didn't know what would work. And in retrospect, there's lots of posturing about what did and didn't and what should or we shouldn't have done, and particularly some of the economic trade-offs associated with those NPIs. That's not the focus of our discussion today. But at the time, this was a deadly virus, and there were various efforts, as you say, undertaken to reduce the spread, particularly prior to the availability of vaccines. But just before we get into the findings, remind us, were those NPIs all lifted the moment we had vaccines?
No. So it really varied at the county level. And again, that's a big reason for evaluating these policies at the county level. The first factor is really that, you know, the vaccination rates varied a lot from county to county. And then also kind of the sentiment about how effective vaccines were versus how effective the policies were, you know, that also varied from county to county. So we actually have some great graphics in our paper where we show how these different policies were repealed and implemented over the course of the pandemic. And what we saw when we dug into the data is that, you know, some counties, when the vaccines started rolling out, started revoking the mandates right away. But counties that actually had higher levels of COVID-19, even during the vaccine rollout, tended to keep their NPIs in place because they felt like they still needed to control the COVID transmission and that the vaccines just weren't enough yet at that point. But we saw by the end of about August 2021, by the time a large part of the country was covered by vaccines, at that point, we see a big drop off of the policies.
This is a researcher's goldmine because you have variation around the country and variation over time. And these are the kinds of things that make for studies. So I think everyone probably thinks they know whether or not these things work because they've been studied fairly extensively. You've extended the literature in an important way. Can you just describe what is different about the approach you took to studying this topic than maybe some of the other things people have heard about whether or not masks work, for example?
Yeah, and thank you for asking this question, Alan, because I think this is a really important one because our study, it really is different in quite a few ways. I think some of these differences could be a key consideration in why there has been historically some inconsistency in the literature around the effectiveness of MPIs, and we think some of these factors might explain why. So one of the first differences to our approach is the majority of studies evaluating the impact of NPIs on COVID transmission were conducted at the state level, like I mentioned. I didn't account for county level differences in the adoption and repeal of NPIs, differences in infection burden, testing levels, and also population socio-demographic characteristics. So this factor is really important because some states allowed counties to make their own decisions about whether to implement MPI mandates. So for example, just off the top of my head, I remember that both Kansas and Tennessee in, you know, the first couple months of the pandemic allowed counties to decide whether or not they wanted face mask mandates. So if you didn't look at the county level, you wouldn't be able to capture all those differences. And so additionally, we also know that even within the same state, from county to county, there was a large variation in factors like COVID-19 testing rates, infection burdens. You know, we know that places with a large population density had much higher infection rates than more rural counties, especially in the beginning where it took a little longer for COVID to reach the rural places. And we also know that, you know, even two counties that border one another can have really large differences in characteristics like the age distribution, population density, things like that, which can really affect the transmission rate of the virus. So to address these shortcomings, we used county-level data for all the variables in our study. So then another important factor is most of the existing studies only covered the first one or two waves of the pandemic. And this could lead to bias in the study results for a few reasons. So over the course of the whole pandemic, our understanding of the virus changed drastically. So for example, in the beginning, which I think, you know, a lot of people can remember, there was a large emphasis on hand washing and cleaning surfaces. I think a lot of people have a funny story about, you know, disinfecting all their groceries and packages before bringing them inside and wearing gloves all the time, you know, things of that nature, because we just didn't understand yet, you know, what was the primary infection mechanism for the virus. The pandemic progressed, you know, scientists and researchers realized that really the main transmission mechanism was respiratory. And then we saw a much larger emphasis on face masks and, you know, PPE. In addition to all of that, you know, treatment protocols and the availability of vaccines also changed a lot over the course of the pandemic, as we discussed earlier. All of these factors likely led to varying levels of public compliance and enforcement of the policies, and also impacted the effectiveness of these NPIs across waves. So for example, if someone believes that the virus is transmitted through surface contact, they're a lot less likely to comply with a mask mandate. And we know that the NPIs are really only as effective as the compliance rates. So to assess the different effectiveness of the NPIs at different stages of the pandemic, we actually evaluated the impact of the NPIs on COVID transmission, both jointly across all of the waves, and then also separately for each of the first four waves of the pandemic. So then finally, another difference in our study is that many of the existing studies only evaluated the impact of just one NPI, or only just a couple, instead of providing a comprehensive evaluation of all the NPIs. So based on our analysis of the NPI data, which I mentioned earlier, we mapped all the NPIs over time, and we took a look through a graph, which will be in the paper, at exactly when these different NPIs were repealed and revoked over the first four waves. And what we found is that a lot of these policies were implemented around the same time. If you analyze the impact of one NPI without adjusting for the other NPIs in your regression model, you ultimately attain an estimate that includes contemporaneous effects from the other NPIs that aren't included in your regression model. So you're not actually really isolating the effect of that policy. So the solution to that would actually be to include all of the NPIs in the same regression model at the same time. But because they were all implemented in tandem, this actually leads to a high degree of multicollinearity in the regression models. And that makes it really difficult to identify the individual policy effects. So to avoid this problem, we actually created a composite NPI variable that captures the simultaneous joint effects of large gathering bans, stay-at-home orders, face mask mandates, and bar and restaurant closures jointly.
Okay, well, so I have a new appreciation of the importance of various dimensions of the study that enable you to draw conclusions about the effects of these that might not be visible in other work that's been conducted. I do want to just sort of jump to the top-level finding. I teased it at the opener, but let's put it all together. Would you say that these non-pharmaceutical interventions collectively are generally effective, were generally effective, have been generally effective in slowing transmission?
Yes. So I'd say the overall big message of the paper based on our results is yes. On average, across all four waves of the pandemic, we found that the joint effects of large gathering bans, stay-at-home orders, face mask mandates, and bar and restaurant closures, that they were jointly effective at slowing COVID-19 transmission.
Okay, so there's the headline. And what we're going to do is talk a little bit more about what's behind that, because it's a great one-line summary, but there's a lot more that you did in your work. We'll dive into some of those details after we take a short break.
Our United Healthcare Community and State Newsletter is your go-to source for the latest Medicaid news and United Healthcare programs serving Medicaid beneficiaries. Subscribe now by visiting our website at uhccs.com/newsletter. Stay in the know by gaining access to our latest blogs, educational videos, and upcoming events. At United Healthcare, our mission is to help people live healthier lives and make the health system work better for everyone in local communities across the U.S.
And we're back. I'm speaking with Courtney Baird about the effectiveness of county-level mandates in slowing COVID-19 transmission. We're talking about NPIs, non-pharmaceutical interventions. We're not looking at the vaccines or the treatments. Before the break, we hit the top-line finding of the study, which is that in the aggregate, these were effective in slowing transmission. I have to ask before we sort of go into more detail, slowing transmission is sort of a funny concept because the virus transmits itself. So what do we really mean when you say it slows the transmission?
Yeah, so I'm really glad you asked this question because this is another part of our study that's a little different from other studies. So what you see in previous studies a lot of time is actually looking at the actual growth rate
the growth rate in the number of people who have COVID-19.
Yes, yes, exactly. And so as I mentioned earlier, we used a survival analysis approach so we could evaluate the impact of the NPIs on different case rate thresholds over time. And we used these different thresholds along the upswing of each of the four waves to allow for the possibility of different policy dosage effects at different infection levels. We also use these thresholds because different COVID-19 case rates are associated with different levels of community transmission, healthcare system strain, and also mortality. So based on existing CDC indicators, our lower thresholds in the study are associated with substantial community transmission and also high levels of community transmission. But then we also evaluate much higher thresholds that we found, based on our analysis, are associated with higher levels of strain on hospital capacity, which ultimately end up resulting in excess mortality and morbidity. So in our paper, we actually provide a table in the appendix, which shows the average levels of COVID-19 hospital admissions and COVID-19 deaths that correspond to each of the COVID-19 case thresholds used in our study. So that basically gives public health officials a tool that they can use to figure out, okay, how many hospitalizations, how many deaths are we averting based on how much of these NPIs we're implementing.
So let me just make sure I follow you here, because this sounds really important and I want to be sure I understand it. The idea here is that this isn't sort of a 1-0 thing. You either have the intervention and no one gets COVID, or you don't have it and everyone gets it. And the ability of the intervention to suppress the rate of transmission may be different if there's very little COVID in the community and if there's a lot of COVID in the community. So is that what you're trying to capture here, is that you don't want to just sort of look at it in the aggregate? You want to look at whether it's increasing or how quickly it's increasing, but not just in the abstract, sort of relative to where it already was. Is that a rough approximation of what you're trying to do?
Exactly, exactly. And we were really interested in seeing, you know, are some of these NPIs more or less effective at different case rate thresholds in the pandemic? And again, that's really important for figuring out how many hospitalizations can we avert, how many deaths can we avert, and, you know, at what point each county can figure out at what point their healthcare systems might become overburdened.
Okay, so with that context, I think I'd now like to try to understand some of the time horizon dimensions. Because again, when I asked you the results, you said yes, in general, in the aggregate, but that's in general. So you mentioned you've studied four waves. Are the effects consistent over time? And obviously the availability of vaccines and treatments has varied over those four waves as well.
So interestingly, we did find that the effects of NPIs were not consistent over the pandemic. They changed. So when we conducted our analyses separately for each wave, we found that overall, the NPIs were really effective during waves 2 and 3, and the effects were a little less significant during waves 1 and 4, which, as we discussed earlier, really highlights the importance of studying the effectiveness of these policies at different points in the pandemic. And so when we observed these results, we did a lot of digging into what may have been going on in each of these separate waves that led to these results. And overall, we found that differing policy effect strengths across waves reflects both the timing and prevalence of NPIs, and then also the presence of mediating factors that influence COVID-19 transmission at different times during the pandemic. So just looking at wave 1, for example, in the beginning of wave 1, there was confusion about the seriousness of the pandemic. Even from our leading politicians and news sources, you know, we were receiving conflicting information from about every avenue. There was also confusion about, you know, which characteristics of the virus were more important than others, and also just a lack of specific guidance from public health officials. And so these factors contributed to a delay in NPI implementation, which caused many counties to implement policies after already having an outbreak, rather than proactively to prevent the outbreak. Kind of what we saw is that in the beginning of the pandemic, a county gets an outbreak and then they implement the NPIs, whereas later on in waves 2 and 3, a lot of them were implementing them before actually having really serious outbreaks. So another factor was that reduced mask availability in the early stages may have also made compliance with face mask mandates more difficult. I personally remember, you know, the first couple weeks when we realized we had to wear face masks, you know, they were sold out everywhere, could only order them from a few places online, and we weren't even sure if they were, you know, verified proper PPE. So it was really hard to get access for some people. And then these early difficulties also were likely the cause of, you know, a lack of the statistical significance for the lower thresholds that take place earlier in wave one, while the significance at higher thresholds probably reflects a longer policy exposure at that point. So like I said, by waves two and three, county officials had a better understanding of COVID-19 transmission mechanisms and also the array of possible mitigation strategies. And there was also stronger policy compliance. I think people in general had a better understanding of the virus and why these MPIs were important. And also the policies were implemented more proactively. And so all those factors are likely why we see much stronger effects of the MPIs in waves two and three. And then finally, wave four was also unique for a couple of reasons. So by the end of wave four, 54% of the country had at least one vaccination, and almost 80% of older adults had a complete vaccination series. So these increasing vaccination rates, which we mentioned in the beginning of the podcast, likely contributed to many counties dropping their policy mandates during wave four. But like I said, the dropping was not at random. So we found that counties with higher COVID-19 levels, counties that were still having trouble controlling COVID-19, they were a lot more likely to keep the NPIs in place for much longer. And so because of that, we ended up seeing this reverse causality in wave four, where higher policy levels were actually associated with higher COVID-19 transmission. And that's really what we see in the results for wave four. And there was also a significant amount of pandemic fatigue during wave four, which probably led to lower rates of compliance. And there's actually a really great body of literature, of survey research on that topic in wave four. So overall, in sum, you know, we found that our stratified wave findings really highlight that the degree of the policy effectiveness depends on timing, dosage, and also compliance.
Yeah, I'm glad we were able to get into this topic because, of course, you are measuring policy variables and compliance. Both the decision to have the policies in place, as you say, has a sort of reverse causality element, and compliance has a reverse causality element. The fact is, having a guideline in place or even a requirement in place, if no one really thinks it's necessary, people are going to behave differently. And if they see people all around them getting COVID, that's going to affect their behavior as well. So this is an important dimension of the analysis, but it has to be surrounded by other elements of context. I do want to ask, you mentioned looking at the four major interventions because you had county level data. Is there anything you can say about which one of them matters most, or is it really just sort of an aggregate picture?
Absolutely. So as I mentioned earlier, from our analysis looking at the MPI data over time, most of the MPIs were adopted and repealed around the same time. But what we did find is that face mask mandates followed a slightly different pattern. And again, you can see this in the graph that we provide in the paper. Face mask mandates were implemented a little bit later on in the pandemic compared to the other policies. So because of this, we decided to actually conduct a sensitivity analysis where we evaluated the separate effects of face mask mandates versus the anti-congregation policies, which include the stay-at-home orders, large gathering bans, and the bar and restaurant closures. And I should also specify that we did actually include both the face mask mandates and the anti-congregation composite variable in the model at the same time. So in these analyses, we found that face mask mandates were actually more effective than the anti-congregation policies on average among all four waves. So this finding is really important because there's been a lot of misconception over the last few years about whether or not face mask mandates are effective. And our study found that they are in fact highly effective at slowing COVID-19 transmission, which makes sense because it's a respiratory virus.
Indeed, it does. But it is important to have the data because, as you note, this is an area of ongoing interest and political controversy, if not scientific controversy. So appreciate you bringing that up. Well, as we come toward the end of our conversation, I want to tie back to sort of the motivation here and the forward-looking dimensions of this. Early on, we heard a lot about the importance of flattening the curve, particularly as you noted earlier on, before we had medical interventions, before we had vaccines, but also before we knew how to treat people who had the condition or prevent it from leading to their death. The focus was slow it down. And as I think about what the top line finding from your paper is, it slowed transmission. So, you know, we think a lot about sort of numbers of people and rates of having COVID and deaths from COVID. But can you just sort of layer the concept of flattening the curve back onto what you tried to do in this study. So that concept sort of fits within the logic of understanding these non-pharmaceutical interventions.
So as you mentioned, you know, one of the greatest threats of the rapid transmission before all the medications and vaccines were available was that health systems would become overwhelmed. And, you know, that leaves both COVID-19 patients and non-COVID patients at risk of not getting access to needed care. Now, I'm sure you can remember in the beginning of the pandemic, there were stories all over the news of people waiting for hours just to get tested, to get access to the necessary treatment. You know, we were running out of ventilators. Like I said earlier, it's, you know, 4 years later, it's easy to forget how serious it was. But those first few months, a lot of people died that, you know, if they got it today or if they'd even gotten it 2 years later, you know, they would have survived because they would have had a hospital bed, they would have had access to a ventilator or, you know, medication or treatment before the access to vaccines and medications. That's really what we're trying to avoid, is people not getting access to necessary care. So one of the main advantages to our survival approach is that our results provide a quantifiable probability of how NPIs can prevent communities from reaching substantial and high levels of community transmission. And our analysis also has a detailed analysis of extremely high transmission levels, which are associated with high levels of healthcare system strain and excess mortality. So in our paper, we provide a table in the appendix that shows the average levels of COVID-19 hospital admissions and also COVID-19 deaths that correspond to each of the COVID-19 case rate thresholds in our study. So this is an incredible tool for local public health officials because they can use this data along with our regression results to show approximately how many COVID-19 hospitalizations and excess deaths would be prevented by implementing these NPIs. And I really think that's the main value added to our study, because when public health officials are faced with, you know, future infectious disease outbreaks or a new COVID-19 variant, they can use our study as evidence to show that NPIs are an effective tool for flattening the curve and preventing this hospital system strain and excess mortality and morbidity.
Well, that's a very nice summary of the importance of this kind of work, because we really are so much in the dark on the medical side at the beginning of a pandemic like this, but we aren't and don't need to be in the dark on the public health side. And obviously, again, there was a lot that we've discussed that we didn't know about how the disease was transmitted. But as that took shape, our ability to have the right kinds of interventions really mattered. And as you note, the effectiveness of those interventions in flattening the curve is very closely tied to people's survival early on when the medical interventions are not available or in limited supply or uncertain. And that delay in the course of the disease going through the population literally saves lives. And from the perspective you described, is also an important part for planning so that you can try your best to have the resources you need. So I appreciate not just the power of the results of the study, but also the detail that they provide those who are trying to avoid this kind of harm in the future. Ms. Baird, thank you for doing the work with your colleagues and for such an excellent job explaining it, giving us a sense of where we were as a country over the last few years. And I know we won't settle all the political debates, but I think adding to the scientific evidence here is critical. Thank you for being my guest today on A Health Podyssey.
Thanks for having me, Alan. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you'll tell a friend about A Health Podyssey.